5, What Lovers Do. In front of that, Janet Jackson, Someone to Call My Lover. Hey, it's 11, no, it's not, it's 13 minutes past 10 o'clock. Time flies when you're having fun. And as I mentioned at the start of the show, my very special guest this morning on the Dave Charles Show is Brett Michelin, I believe is probably the closest I'll come to the actual pronunciation of your name. Is that good or is it Michelin?
Yeah, it's quite good.
Are you happy with that?
Yeah, I'm quite happy with that.
Great. Now, Brett, you have done extraordinary things in the past couple of years, from a chef to the owner of an extraordinary franchise of restaurants. Mozambique has become synonymous with good things in this part of the world and has spread the word across the continent, and international player now as well, I believe. So this is exciting stuff. But where did it begin? Take us back. Where did you grow up? Yeah.
Okay, so I grew up in Shangweni. So literally right next door to the Shangweni Farmers Market is where I lived. So that's where I started. My folks, my dad was a casino manager many years ago at the Royal Swazi Sun. He'd had enough of the casino game, and he just said it was the most depressing thing he'd ever worked in. And he moved his whole family to Shangweni. My mother brought her 68 horses across with her. My old man almost went mad. He said, I'd be a rich man today if it wasn't for your mother and her horses. So
why 68 horses?
My mom used to have the Royal Swazi the Royal Swazi stables, the stables at the basically a horse riding school at the Swazi casino, the Royal Swazi.
And so she brought her horses with her.
With her.
68.
By train, yeah. And they stopped at where you see that waterfall when you go to the Shangweni Farmers Market, the Dalvewood Station used to be open years ago. They offloaded the horses there and they rode them all up and around through to the through to the farm.
So so you could have been a cowboy, really.
I was a bit of a cowboy. Still a bit of a cowboy.
Do you still ride? Do you ride?
No, but I am a cowboy. and then basically my dad was working for Game. He got a job at Game, ended up with CNA. And for years, he always had this thing. Everyone said, oh, you know, Mitch, you cook so well. His name was Armando, but everyone used to call him Mitch. Mitch, you cook so well, you know, you should open a restaurant. And when I was, as a family, we always cooked together and so on like that. So, when it was coming time, sort of just decide on careers, I wanted to either do two things. I wanted to do diving or go into the restaurant game and become a chef. Glad I didn't go into the diving. And the last year, my dad took early retirement and he bought Bothersfield Station. And that's where we started. So I was in the kitchen, he was on the floor, and we ran it together.
In the old station building?
Yeah.
So he converted that into a...
So it was going already. There was a guy, I forget what their first name was, but the Trent Plumbers, we were quite a big plumbing company in Durban many years ago. His wife, Jenny, had the business, and my dad bought it off them. And it was like a coffee shop at that time.
And he wasn't a professional chef?
No, no.
Just a passion?
Yeah, yeah.
And he took the former station buildings that had been converted to a coffee shop.
And we turned it into a full-blown Italian restaurant. So we turned it to Alla Stazione, which was an Italian-style restaurant.
Is that your heritage? Are you Italian?
Yeah, Italian, yeah.
And how does one pronounce your surname?
Micheli.
Micheli.
Yeah. Micheli.
No. Micheli.
Yeah.
So, do you speak Italian?
Absolutely not. I get a lot of shit for it.
But you have a passion for food, which is pretty much an Italian passion.
Yeah, I still cook a lot of Italian now.
Ah. Yeah. And you came into the restaurant as a kid, really.
So I was writing my final exams and I was running my dad's kitchen. So it wasn't very good for the exams. It was very good for me as a career, but
Now, they said that the restaurant business is hard.
You know, I have this argument with a lot of people. It's hard if you make it hard. So the restaurant game is like the army. You put the systems into place and the things work. You know what I'm saying? So if you don't have those systems in place and stuff like that, you're gonna suffer. And that's the reality of it, you know.
And as a youngster, who taught you the systems?
I go back. So when I was 17, that's when I started. When I first started, there was no systems. We just used to suck thumb, you know, just make do a thing. I mean, the old point of sales didn't capture anything. I mean, it was a big joke. I mean, I ended up doing about 3 years with my dad, and I went over to Switzerland to study, and then I lectured at the hotel school.
So, did you want to go and learn to cook in Switzerland, or was this an idea that you just was going to take a break?
No, it was more of a case that I wasn't going to stay with my dad forever in his restaurant. It was more of a case that I needed some sort of paperwork behind me. You know, when it comes to, I have this thing about chef schools and stuff. It's great to get your basics, see if you really want to do it, but you're going to learn it out in the business. You know, I mean, a lot where I learned was I used to work for Ocean Basket many years ago when I was a kid. I'd done quite a bit before I joined Ocean Basket.
Before you got into the family business, you was?
No. So this was between Switzerland. I worked in the UK and a couple of places in Europe and stuff. And I ended up back in SA. Working for Ocean Basket, and I lied at my interview so to get the job. And said, you know, like, oh, of course. Do you know how to cost me? Said, yeah, 100%. Great. And it was before internet was like readily available. You know what I'm saying?
So no one could check.
But also the other side is I had to learn very quickly and make a plan quite quickly. They're like, okay, good. You can cost the new menus for the group. And I went, oh, okay. And I had to teach myself how to, cause I mean, I'd done costing, but I mean, student stuff, you know, it wasn't costing a whole group's restaurant menu. Yeah.
So you're not averse to taking a risk.
Yeah, no, I don't have a problem.
Wait, that was a hell of a risk.
That is a big risk.
Talk yourself into a position.
Yeah, but I had to also prove it then, so I had to get it done.
And to succeed, were you a success with
that? Yeah, and you know what happened with that? I actually, learning all that, I really got a love for it. And the whole idea of systems and how to run everything down to percentages. I mean, I look at numbers. When I look at restaurant numbers, I don't look at the turnovers or whatever. I just look at percentages and go, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's good, that's wrong. That's the great thing about it. It taught me a lot. You know what I'm saying? So although it was hectic at the time, it's probably my strongest point now. And I literally, when I wrote my last accounting exam, I needed 105% to pass. And that's my strongest. Like, I'm really good at numbers, like ridiculously good.
And that's just from doing it.
Yeah.
So academically you weren't strong, but practically you were
absolutely
powerful.
Absolutely not. I spent my life on daily report. Because they did aptitude tests and IQ tests and stuff like that, and they were like, this kid's messing around here. he's doing well on these, but on schools there's no go. And when I got to Switzerland, I really enjoyed what I was doing, and I always think that's maybe what it was. I really enjoyed like the restaurant game and the food game.
But how did you cope? Because I presume you didn't speak Swiss.
So it's an international school. So you had to learn a language. You either chose German or French, but your classes were all in English.
Yeah. So you're conversational in which of those two languages did you choose?
I chose French.
So you speak French now?
Absolutely not. Like I said, I'm not very good at it. I barely speak English properly. I'm a numbers person. I'm not a language person. I battle. You must hear me talk Afrikaans. It's shocking.
But this is an extraordinary. So you went to Switzerland and you spent 3 years learning the finer points, I presume, of cooking.
Yes.
Did they teach you anything about running a restaurant, or did you already have a pretty good idea?
No, so it was quite different. You know, Europe works very different to Africa. Where, you know, when I got back to, I went to Switzerland again this year, my old boss and sort of my mentor when I was there was retiring. So I went to go visit him and went around the school and to go check it out and so on like that, and how it changed. Running restaurants is very different. It's a lot more hectic in South Africa. Because everyone does a cookie cutter sort of thing. So in Switzerland, the food's quite boring because they all cook the same thing. So if you want to go to if you want to have Chinese food, you'll go to a Chinese restaurant. You know what I'm saying? So, and I'm talking about general restaurants, just in general. You know what I mean? Like, it's not 100 restaurants. Like if I look at the bottom of a liter and you put that into any area in Switzerland, you'll never have that sort of density of restaurants.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
and why is that?
I think what they do, you know, Swiss protect their businesses to a certain degree. Hotels are protected, and what you like, if you want to open a restaurant in Switzerland, you must be qualified. So you must have some sort of some certification behind you.
So you can't just be an entrepreneur and decide.
And I can't go, well, this is a place I'm going to put a restaurant, and the council will say we have opportunities for 10 restaurants, and that's it.
So it's pretty Well, it's typically Swiss, in fact.
Yeah, very, very Swiss. Yeah. It's not my cup of tea. I mean, I felt when I got there, we've gone backwards. Although the wonderful thing about Swiss, I don't want to knock this, I loved living in Switzerland. It's sort of very parat. There's no, I would definitely, if I, I'm, like I always say, I'm too feral for the first world. I'd definitely be arrested there. That I'm saying. So it's a, for me, it's like I like living in Africa and I love South Africa.
So you like the unpredictability.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Opportunities. It's opportunities. Everyone looks at
that. Now that's an interesting thing because a lot of folks say that no matter what the politics and no matter what the zeitgeist generally and the negativity for every person that leaves, creates an opportunity for someone that stays. Your philosophy?
You know, and yes, but you know what I also said? I mean, everyone goes, oh, you know, Zimbabwe is a mess and the whole lot. I go, our busiest store in the group is in Zimbabwe, and it's one of three shops in Harare. And if you go look at the guys that stuck it out and stayed, the Oaks have made a lot of money, and they've done exceptionally well for themselves. I mean, not everyone, but if you look at the majority of the guys that stuck it out and stayed, they've done exceptionally well.
I hear that, and I hear that they've created their own infrastructure. Yeah. They have schools, and they have power, and they have water, and they have, you know, whatever they need. They can't rely on the government, so they've made a plan.
I mean, if you look at the Mozambican Chusipiti, which is the main store I'm talking about, that big one. That store off, so it's got a massive kids section. I mean, the kids section is bigger than the whole of Mozambique Belito, like by far, I guess. It's got this big covering over it. The restaurant's quite big. They've got a warehouse next door, which they bring in goods for the other stores. They don't just own Mozambique. They've got King Pie, and they've got part of the Life and Brands. They've just opened up, La Parada's been going for a while, which is part of Life and Brands. And then obviously one that everyone knows is, what's it called? Tiger's Milk.
Oh.
And with off the roofs of just that, like so, the Mozambique, the distribution and the kids section, they generate a third of a megawatt of power a day. Like I've never seen batteries that big in any establishment that I've ever walked into an SA saying, yeah, this is our backup power. It's like proper. It's a room full of batteries that need to be craned in. You don't lift them up, you know.
So it's a fact that Africa produces opportunity for those that are keen to make it work. And obviously you need to put in the effort. That goes without saying. And you've done extraordinarily in that regard. Let's take a little interlude, a musical interlude, and we'll come back. My very special guest, Brett Michaeli, with me on the Dave Charles Show, powered by Bidvest McCarthy Toyota Belito. Brian Adams, straight from the heart, 29 minutes past 10 o'clock, and we're back in conversation with Brett Michaeli from Mozambique, actually from Belito, but you know, the Mozambique brand is the flagship of your enterprise, Brett, but you're involved in other things as well. I know that one of the very exciting developments is the warehouse for distribution, and now yes. Mozambique products are available in supermarkets, for argument's sake. That must be quite a change of direction for you.
So it came up during COVID. You know, we started that's what actually saved Mozambique during COVID was pre-packed frozen meals. And that's
an opportunity that was a problem that you turned into an opportunity.
Yeah, and you know, I still laugh at this thing. Like when we did the box of chicks, that was our main thing originally, was the 10 half babies. That's how we got them out during COVID. And what happened was I packed five whole baby chickens and I put it at 350, and it was a bit slow. So then I cut them in half and I repackaged 10 half babies at 399. And it went like hotcakes.
Why?
I think it's a numbers thing, you know, just people go, and it was exactly the same product at 49 Rand more. And it took off. And I thought, well, all the work to cut them and redo them, let me add 49 Rand and see what happens. And it worked. Yeah.
Now that's interesting. Yeah. So it's purely a perception thing with the public.
Yeah. So it's like chickens, you know, like everyone goes, oh, this business got a chicken for $200 or whatever. It's cool. What size is the chicken? Because I can get you an 800 gram chicken, I can get you 1.4 kilo chicken. You know, there's a big difference between the two, you know. So, but yeah, it's perception. It's a big thing. It's quite tricky how you do it on a menu. You know, when someone goes, oh, this half chicken and calamari is this price, but yours is this price. You know, using a spring chicken is a kg, ours is 30% more.
Now, you know, what you're talking about is absolutely fascinating, because I have an idea that most people, well, in the current economy, most people are very price conscious and resist the idea that food is expensive and restaurants are expensive, etc. And ding, 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 ding. And when there is a special, then we will go. But often the special is kind of disappointing, because in order for the special to still make money, or to break even, maybe it's a loss leader, something's got to go. And generally it's the size of the portion, or the, you know, whatever. And then there's a disappointment factor. Well, that actually was not so expensive. It wasn't delightful. Whereas if you have a really super meal and it's a little bit more expensive, that delight outweighs the extra cost. It's a difficult one, though, from a marketing point of view. How do you combat that?
So if you're looking at a special, so there's a couple of things about special and how they work. So normally it's obviously a price-related thing. So you have to drive the price to where it needs to be. Like, the craziest thing, as time's gone by, prawn is cheaper than steak now. And I never ever thought I'd say that today.
Is that a fact?
Yeah. Prawn actually at the moment is cheaper than hake at the moment.
Good heavens. How does that work? Are these prawns that are grown in puddles in Thailand or somewhere like that?
So you've got different styles of prawns. So you can get the Indian tigers and stuff. You've got the ones in Thailand and Vietnam.
Freshwater prawns.
Freshwater, but then you've got the Ecuadorian, which is pumped freshwater and then into seawater. Then you've got the Gulf prawn, which for me is the best prawn at the moment. It's basically farmed in 100% seawater.
Okay.
So the days of fish prawn, you got the Argentinian deep sea prawn. It's not my favorite prawn. You know, the problem with it is a deep sea prawn spoils quicker. So it's not that it's off, but it goes softer quicker and the heads fall off, and it's all head, that prawn. There's no meat on it. It looks fantastic on a plate, got this big head on it, you know, and people go, oh, look at the size of the prawns. But if you measure the protein that you're actually eating, it's six of one, half a dozen of the other, you know. So
which is the one that you are crazy about? So we
use the Saudi Arabian prawn, and I use the Ecuadorian prawn. Those are the two that I jump into.
Both from salt water.
So Ecuadorian is, fresh water to salt with into salt. So in the perfect world, I get from Saudi continuously. At the moment, funny enough, we've still got stock. I thought when they closed down the strait, we'd have a bit of problem, but we haven't actually yet. So we're still running on
still coming through. And pardon the pun, but prawns from Mozambique? No.
Gone.
Finished.
Gone. Long time. If you get, it can go all over the place. So the quality can sometimes be good. Is it still available? Yes. Is it available that there's loads of them and you can buy a couple of containers and it's all going to be good product? No. I haven't seen it for a long time. And the guys that are getting it right are the guys that have had the connections for years and years and years, and they're getting. But I mean, I think they were called Pescanova or something like that. They were a 25 fleet fishing charter up fishermen in I think they're based in Barra, if I'm not mistaken. Bilin or Barra, I can't remember where they're based. Those boats are all gone now, so that whole fleet is gone, and so it's you're dealing with, I think, a couple of local guys that are trying to get it done, but it doesn't exist anymore.
So the prawns that you serve most consistently come from Saudi Arabia, and a good supply, good value. You do some incredible specials with prawns, particularly. Yeah. I've noticed, and clearly it's a popular attraction. The deal on the plate is a popular attraction, but I have an idea that currently food prices in South Africa generally are very expensive.
So it has gone up. So the one thing is that prawn at the moment is actually going to come down by the looks of it. So only prawn, but so butter's shot up through the roof. I think because of the foot and mouth, that's obviously put pressure on the dairy. Meat has gone up, but it's coming down again. It's not where it should be yet. But you'll start seeing the special. I've seen a couple of specials around that the meat's going to be better. Chicken is consistently going up, but it ticks up. It doesn't shoot up by massive amount.
It's incremental and eventually.
If you think about it, when we started, we were paying 15 rand a kg for chicken, and now we're on about 38. So it's 21 years ago. It's not really that off the chart. Cream has shot up through the roof. That's also dairy based. What I do is I throw a sales mix in our restaurants, and I watch a gross profit that a theoretical gross profit that we work on. And if it's gone up and down, but it's probably down by about 0.4% over the last couple of months, it's not too much. Okay. So, going back onto the special side of it. So how we cost a special, a special's marked up by 50% maximum. Okay. That's where we push it to. Then what we do, if I'm making a dish that's different, it's not a special. I'm doing something else. You know, like Trev makes on our specials board, we got this and this and this. They're not specials. He's trying out things. Like, you know, Trev does all his cool things with his curries and stuff like an El Pescatore. And he's always got the specialities more. So those aren't discounted. Those are just normal things. And if I'm doing a special to it, like a call to action special, like the our prawn thing on a Wednesday, we mark up by 50% on that. But what we look at is not what that prawn special brings. It's the sales mix that the people spend around.
Which is generally the way, think strawberries philosophy.
Yeah.
If you've got a hotel that's empty, the beds are there, the staff is there, you might as well give away the bed night because people are going to spend a lot more in the restaurant because they've saved so much on the bed.
Yeah. So, and it's a true thing. And I mean, we all like a bargain. You know, years ago, we still do the Saturday special. We've marked it up to 50% now because we didn't cross the brand. But in the old days, I used to mark up by 20 rand in Mozambique, a Belita. So I'd get cost plus 20 rand, we sold the special, no matter what it was. And then the whole theory was, and I analyzed what was going on in the store. And the whole theory was that people would walk in and they'd have a budget. Today, I've got this budget of 200 bucks. Okay. I walk in and I've got a special. Okay, and I'm going to have the special, and we're going to have the special. Me and you are going to have the special. We're going to have a bottle of wine because we have the special. We'd normally have a bottle of wine. But, you know, we saved a bit of money. Should we have another bottle of wine? Yeah, that's a good idea. So when the second bottle goes, the third bottle goes. So people were actually, and honest truth, people were spending more having the special. Yes, you obviously got your bargain hunters, but it's so few. You know what I'm saying? It's 10% maybe.
But that then bears up what I was talking about earlier, that people, if you delight the customer, the original reticence to spend the money goes because you're having such a good time. Yeah. And you genuinely, the joy of having saved a few rand is way overshadowed by the joy of having had a really good time. So it's an interesting psychological exercise, and clearly you've got it right, because how many Mozambique stores are extant at the moment? How many are there?
45.
And how does it work? Do you franchise and supply, or do you have a share in them?
So no. So we franchise. So basically what happens is the guys will buy into the franchise. We'll set up the shop. I then make money on the build. So if it costs me 5 million rand, it'll cost you 5 million rand. It's not, there's no markup as far as that's concerned.
But you oversee the build.
We oversee the build. We supply the plans and the whole lot like that. Then they buy stock from us, which is our stock that's on our lists to buy. So I can't say you will buy salt from me. You know what I'm saying? But if I put in a Mozambique bag, I could sell salt to you because it says Mozambique on it. Now it becomes a company thing. But I'm not interested in doing that, you know. So we look at more on the recipe side. So the sources have to come from us. And it's more to get the standard right. You know what I'm saying?
So pretty much important. The McDonald's, you buy a Big Mac in Beijing, Taiwan, Brazil, London. It's the same taste.
Yeah, but I mean, the guys will still, I mean, we run operations teams that we basically per operations manager. If I include the back, we have front of house operations managers and back of house operations managers. If I put all of them together, we run one operations manager between like 4 to 5 stores. So we spend a lot of time in our stores. And I mean, the guys still make mistakes. Don't get me wrong. I mean, like it's one of my things, like, guys, you know, it's quite simple. Like, just follow what we're doing, and then everything else will fall into play. And I mean, Bolito is not not unfillable. I promise you now. It drives me insane in my own shop where I have to sit and go, are we really having this discussion about whatever it is? Like, why have you not given this customer peanuts? You know, we've only been doing it for 21 years and now we stopped giving the guys peanuts, you know? And you know, guy will have the grade and goes, ah, I see they cut corners. They didn't put the peanuts on the table. And I'm going, that's unnecessary, you know, because we have the peanuts. You know? So yeah.
Interesting. How many years have you been running the Mozambique brand now?
So Mozambique is 21 this year. I joined Louis 18 months into it. So I've been 19 years.
And in that time, what has been your greatest success?
I think probably our central kitchens. And probably two things, our central kitchens and also the fact that we've got that fantastic vein into Africa, which a lot of guys haven't succeeded in doing properly. Into Zambia. I mean, Zambia, we have four Mozambiques in Zambia. We have four in Zim. Swaziland, we've got one. We're going to do one now, but I mean, Swaziland's quite a small country. We're doing Namibia now. Are we tracing at the moment? We'll get the vein. It's all about supply. So the main thing is once I got the veins up, I can supply. We're finalizing Tanzania now to do one in Dar es Salaam. So we're getting it out there and so on. But
so you're literally becoming a sort of pan-African brand.
Yeah. So, I mean, guys always phone me and say, well, can we do a store in the UK? I was like, I don't want to work hard. Are you mad? My days are, I'm an old fart now. I don't want to work hard. I want to drink beer.
And talking of challenges, I know that generally speaking in the hospitality trade in South Africa, some of the best staff tend to be foreign African nationals. And with this current push to rid South Africa of foreign African nationals, are you affected?
So not really. So you've got to remember something. When I opened up Zim, we already knew it was on the cards. I mean, and we've had Zim now going for 4 years now. So we sent you've got legal, foreigners in here. And then the guys that had like those funny sort of, ZN or whatever, the ZN visas, or whatever they were called. I can't remember Z visas or whatever they were called that came out that sort of disappeared. Those guys all went back. So, I mean, I've got a couple across the group, but it's not a huge amount. You know, we stopped hiring foreigners a long time ago. So the guys that are in now that are here have been with us for 15, 20 years, you know what I'm saying? And what we've done now, which I know is going to come, you don't really have the problem really in South Africa, in KZN. It's more of a Joburg thing and a Cape Town thing. Like Cape Town's got a lot of foreigners in the kitchens, and so is Joburg. And you go look at like the Zimbabwean staff. The reality is 15 years ago, South Africans, for whatever reason, weren't working in the restaurants. If I went up to Joburg, it was only Zimbabweans.
Yeah.
And everyone goes, oh, but you know, they work better. That's rubbish. It's how you manage people. You
know, okay, so that's encouraging.
My best staff in my operations that have come up from kids that are now, like, I mean, like an Ipo goes to Zim to check on the stores and stuff, are Zulu guys, you know?
Okay.
So the whole idea that, oh, you know, it's like saying, oh, Dave, because you're English speaking, you can't be a radio DJ because the best are from Germany. You know what I'm saying? Mm. I mean, it's ridiculous, you know, right? It's how you treat your staff and so on like that. I mean, my oldest staff are Zulu. And my best was again.
Yeah. It's interesting. And we're coming to the end of our chat now, and it's been fascinating. And thank you for that. One thing I wanted to ask you before we say goodbye, you have always had an incredible heart for the community and for helping people that have experienced difficulty. Is this something that is by design or by nature? In other words, do you believe it's good business or is it because you actually care?
So I was brought up with a family that my mom worked for animal into cruelty for a long time. And we were very much as a family voice on that, but it leads to good business because people trust you. You know what I'm saying? So that's the reality of it. You know, and when everyone goes like, oh, man versus food is quite a busy thing. You know, you make a decent amount of money. Yeah, we do. It's a busy night, but also the infrastructure goes into making sure man you do it if you do a prawn, our normal 99 rand prawn on a Wednesday, it's better business. But on the longer run of things, it does work fantastically well. You know what I'm saying? And people trust you. That's the whole thing. You know, people rather support people that support their town.
Okay, well, you certainly have proven that point, because if there is one man that stands out in the crowd in the greater Ballito scheme of things for having done good for the community, it is you, and I salute you for that.
There's lots of people like me.
There are many, but you stand head and shoulders above most. And it's a fair comment. You do a hell of a lot for the community, and you deserve to do well as a result, because you know there are jewels in the crown, and we like to celebrate those. There is a bit of a rumor doing the rounds that you're looking at expanding into a rebranding of Thirsties in Durban.
So not a rebranding, reopening.
A reopening.
Yeah, so Bob Humphreys started Thirsties many years ago.
It was terrific. I remember right where the ships came in.
So we've got a couple of sites yet. We haven't put a signature to any site yet. We've got options on sites. I'm aiming for one. I'm not going to say anything until I can get it. There's a couple of hoops that I have to jump through. Well, we have to jump through. But how I got onto this, for a long time, I thought, you know, Thirsties really needs to be reopened again. So I actually phoned Bob, and I phoned him, and I said to him, "How's it, Bob? Listen, I want to talk to you about Thirsties. I want to know if you want to partner with me, and I want to ask your blessing so we can reopen Thirsties." And he goes, "Brett, I got no money. I'm retired." I was like, "I didn't ask you for money. I asked if you wanted to become my partner and let's reopen Thirsties." And he was like, "I'd love to do that. I'm so bored now." You know, I said, "Cool, let's get it going." And it was a process that we started about a year ago, and we're slowly getting all the ducks in a row. It hasn't been easy to try and get everything in place. I've got a mate of mine that's coming out from the UK. I'm going to try convince to stay. So he's going to come out of, I'm flying his whole family out, yeah, because she's from Czech Republic and she's not quite sure about South African safety. I was like, bring her to Never Neverland, bring her to Ballito. She'll understand it's not that bad. So I'm flying him out so I can convince him to help us with the operational side of things. I mean, Bob's 78. I don't expect him to open closed restaurants. You know what I'm saying? It's going to be hectic. And yeah, I'm working on that at the moment to get it right. Menus are done. Myself and Bob got a meeting this week just to go touch base on a couple of things. I have to put him back on Facebook because he's like, "Oh, Brett, you know, lots going on." Then people are phoning me. I was like, "Yeah, you must go onto Facebook." So I'm helping Bob open up his Facebook account and stuff like that. But I'm very excited about it. I've wanted to do it for a long time. And we're pushing towards a great site that's, I think, will rejuvenate a big part of the harbor that needs rejuvenation. I've got a big love for Durban. It's just the saddest part that Wilson's Wharf started before the V&A, and the V&A is the V&A, and the Wilson's Wharf sits the way it does. There's so much opportunity.
So you envisage bringing life back to
the harbor in general, you know what I'm saying? I mean, and listen, our Mozambican Wilson's Wharf does fantastic business there. But it could do that. The area needs an upgrade, you know, it needs a bit of a, you know, you just clean it up. And you know, the broken window theory about you fix all the broken windows and things will start to clean up by themselves. That whole idea. Just clean up. There's a huge opportunity. Durban is a beautiful city. You know, it's sad how it's gone, but it's not the end of the world.
But you see opportunities where there are problems, and clearly this is one of them. Yeah, if you bring back Thirsties,
it'll bring people back to the harbor, and people will realize that I love spending time down there. You know what I'm saying? And it's a special place. And I mean, it's crazy, like how you've got, the Esplanade, where anywhere else in the world would be the most expensive flats. And I own a 4-bedroom house, a flat in John Ross. I paid $400,000 for it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's crazy. Anywhere else in the world, that would be $400,000. You know what I'm saying?
So there's still lots of shall we say, you have plans for the future. Yeah, you're not planning to retire anytime soon.
Absolutely not. And also I think, you know, with this whole thing that happened with the march and stuff, unfortunately, there was a lot of a seedy element in Durban that probably is going to disappear now, which is not I don't like people being hostile on people, but I don't think it's the end of the world. You know what I'm saying? I think it's going to be good for South Africa in the long run. You could see it. There's people trading on streets and stuff. It's just ridiculous. You can't, with these shop owners and stuff like that, and people are just sitting up and trading. It's not right. You know what I'm saying? And it's going to bring us back to, it's going to affect the economy negatively, firstly, but it'll change and it'll go back. And I truly believe if we get that right, Durban can improve a hell of a lot.
Well, here's to that. I wish you continued success. And thank you so much for spending time talking to us on
the show. Just one more thing, Dave, just before you finish off. The one thing that I wanted to say is the whole idea of the restaurants going to be battling now with staff is I'm trying to put up with a couple of guys, we're trying to put something together where we're going to open up a training school to get kids under Sharker's Crawl, Sharker's Head, Sharker's Crawl, and probably up to Grafful and Tete and the whole lot to come through and train. So six in the front of us, six in the back of us. Once they're trained, we've got staff to hand out to restaurants that have lost their Zimbabwean waiters or the Mozambique kitchen guys or whatever.
And is that a go? Are you starting?
So we're starting soon. I'm just tying up the last couple of things on it to set up. I just want to get us accredited so we can actually get accreditation. I can start training now and I'll get your waiters up, but they won't have any certification. They can have the Mozambique certificate. It's not something that's accredited, you know what I'm saying? So that's where we're going with it.
So that's the next big thing.
It's 12 people at a time, but it'll just help feed in. And I know it's going to be one of those things, like literally when it doesn't affect us now. Like I said to you, years ago, we moved our guys up to Zim, but there are restaurants in the Cape, for example. I mean, I've seen a lot of kids from here to the Cape to go start their careers and so on like that. So up to Joburg, whatever the case is. Those are the two areas that are mostly affected by the foreign, in the restaurant game.
Okay. So you're taking care of two problems, the unemployment problem and now the migrant problem.
Hopefully, I mean, this is still new. And I'm going to see how it works. We'll do a couple of things, see what happens and hopefully it works.
We wish you huge continued success with Mozambique, with Thirsties, with the training program. And I'm sure this is just the beginning for Brett McAleen, who's been my special guest on the Dave Charles Show.
Thanks, Dave.
The show brought to you proudly by Bidvest McCarthy Toyota Bolito.